Following are comments on William Shakespeare's Macbeth, Act 4. What, will the line stretch out to the crack of doom? Macbeth goes to the weird sisters to know the rest of the truth, and gets more of a vision than he bargained for. Banquo's royal line will stretch, as we know, all the way to King James I. Act 4, Scene 1, like Act 3, Scene 5, seems to have been at least partially written by Thomas Middleton. Determined to know the worst, Macbeth meets for the second time with the weird sisters, and when prodded, they end up telling him more than he really wants to know. Three apparitions come in succession, each with its own information to impart. The first is, quote-unquote, an armed head that tells Macbeth to, quote-unquote, beware Macduff. The second is, quote-unquote, a bloody child that says, quote-unquote, none of woman born will harm him. And the third, a crowned child holding a tree in his hand, proclaims that only when Birnam Wood comes to Dunsinane Hill will he be defeated. Act 4, Scene 1, lines 70 through 93 inclusive. Taken together, these prophecies offer, or at least appear to offer, assurance that comes very close to full certitude. Still, Macbeth remains unsatisfied. He demands information about Banquo's line, and is presented with a series of eight kings, Banquo being the eighth and clutching a magic mirror image of his issue reigning forever. This vision profoundly unsettles Macbeth, and he exclaims in shock, quote-unquote, what, will the line stretch out to the crack of doom? Act 4, Scene 1, line 116. Macbeth considers his own life safe, but that isn't enough. He is frustrated, since for him, as with most monarchs, perpetuity is the ultimate emblem of success. If Banquo's issue will reign after him, what is the point of anything he has done? Macbeth will do anything to secure his throne, perpetual or not, so he resolves from this time onward to perform his bloody deeds as soon as they are conceived. Macduff has become a kind of proxy Banquo, since he is Macbeth's strongest and most resolute opponent at this point. As the bad king says in soliloquy, quote-unquote, from this moment, the very firstlings of my heart shall be the firstlings of my hand. Ellipsis, the castle of Macduff I will surprise. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 143 through 147 and 149. Macduff's entire family is to be slaughtered. There is no time allotted for reflection and certainly no occasion for pity. No parliament of good angels and bad angels will Macbeth allow to fight in his soul, for his soul. Only ruthless action is called for now. This declaration about firstlings, quote-unquote, of heart and hand indicates that an astonishing process of spiritual atrophy has begun in Macbeth, and once begun, it will continue until he is, for all intents, a walking corpse. The eerie thing about this tragic protagonist is that as the process unfolds, he seems to know that it's happening, yet he allows it to run its course all the same. Macbeth's is a case of furious action underlain by spiritual sloth. His flight was madness. Ross and a messenger visit Lady Macduff's home just before Macbeth's agents storm in and kill the family of his most hated enemy. Lady Macduff and her little son give us a very different perspective on war. In Act 4, Scene 2, Ross comes to the castle at Fife where Macduff has left his family. This loyal friend tries to justify Macduff's decision to leave the family alone while he goes to seek military assistance against Macbeth, but it's hard going. Lady Macduff's response is mingled love and anger. Quote-unquote, his flight was madness. When our actions do not, our fears do make us traitors. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 3 through 4. She also complains, heartrendingly, quote-unquote, to leave his wife, to leave his babes, his mansion and his titles in a place from whence himself does fly, he loves us not. Act 4, Scene 2, lines 6 through 8. Her words to her son suggest that she fears her husband is already dead. Ross soon departs. Before they are cruelly murdered, Lady Macduff and her son give us a scalding perspective on the great events that overtake them and afflict the kingdom of Scotland. The boy's innocence strikes home when he says in response to Lady Macduff's insistence that traitors must be hanged, quote-unquote, "The liars and swearers are fools, for there are liars and swearers enough to beat the honest men and hang up them." Act 4, Scene 2, lines 54 through 55. How truly the boy speaks. Macbeth, the blasphemous traitor, would no doubt agree, if, that is, he weren't such a huge liar bent upon defending his ill-got gains. Soon thereafter, a frightened messenger arrives and begs Lady Macduff to leave the castle at once. But it is too late. Macbeth's thugs burst in, immediately stab the child, and set after the lady to kill her as well. Perhaps Shakespeare tried to limit the psychic damage inflicted on his audience by this scene, in that later, Macduff's anguished reaction to the news has him mentioning all of his children, so there must have been more than one. In 1933, L.C. Knights wrote a mocking lecture titled, quote-unquote, "How Many Children Had Lady Macbeth?" At the risk of outraging the ghost of Professor Knights, who, like his past living self, we may presume, still considers it silly to offer conjectures on a fictive family's real children beyond the play in which they have their only existence, we might ask the same question about Lady Macduff's brood. In the present scene, we hear and see the awful private consequences of public disorder. Before the murderers break in, though, we also see an emphasis on the natural affective ties that bind people and reinforce charity and social order. Both Ross and the lower-class messenger show more concern for Lady Macduff and her family than anyone shows for anyone else in the play. This is a degree of humanity that Macbeth and his queen have scorned, but it rings true in the teeth of the wicked system they have erected over their murderous gamble. Why did Macduff leave the family unprotected? To us, he may seem culpable in this, since he puts affairs of state before his family's safety. But it's fair to say that Macduff, like so many good characters in Shakespeare, probably couldn't imagine the depths of depravity to which a wretch like Macbeth could sink. Unfortunately, wickedness tends to outpace goodness, and what some people can scarcely conjure in a nightmare, others readily do without conscience or remorse. Macbeth, after all, said just a scene ago that he would no longer bother to reflect on whatever vicious thoughts entered his head. He would just put them into action without seeking the counsel of his own conscience. Good men's lives expire before the flowers in their caps. Malcolm tests Macduff's loyalty by proclaiming his own depravity. Ross informs Macduff that his family has been slain by Macbeth's agents. In Act 4, Scene 3, when Macduff arrives in England, the Scottish heir Malcolm laments his country's downfall and voices skepticism as to whether Macduff's intentions are honorable or treasonous. Macduff rebuffs this suspicion, but Malcolm is determined to test him by mock confessing to Macduff what an awful villain he himself is. Next to him, he says, the traitor Macbeth is, quote-unquote, as pure as snow. Act 4, Scene 3, line 53. Macduff's answers to Malcolm's claims of debauchery reduce to an admission that no one expects kings to behave anyway. But Malcolm's intention is only to test Macduff's moral steadfastness, and it is the man's final expression of disgust with the sum of Malcolm's vices that convinces the young prince he's on the level. Macduff laments, quote unquote, "These evils thou repeat'st upon thyself hath banished me from Scotland. O my breast, thy hope ends here." Act 4, Scene 3, lines 112 through 114. Malcolm's ploy underscores the crime Macbeth committed in moving from thought to act, and ultimately his interaction with Macduff reassures us that while all human nature is corrupted, the corruption's effects can be kept in check, at least by those who are determined to do so. Macbeth's Throne of Blood, that's Akira Kurosawa's title for his 1957 film, recasting Macbeth as a samurai-themed tale, need not become the universal, irresistible pattern of royal conduct. Even though we saw in the previous scene what happens to the innocent when nobility does not resist, such a failure produces derangement and denaturation of the landscape and destruction of life and property, as is well indicated by Ross when he says that in Scotland, quote-unquote, good men's lives expire before the flowers and their caps, dying or ere they sicken. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 171 through 173. Macduff is relieved to hear that Malcolm was only testing him, and there is much helpful news thanks to the help coming miserable Scotland's way from England's King Edward the Confessor, whose praises the three Scotsmen have just been singing. 10,000 troops are Edward's contribution to the Scottish effort to rid the nation of its tyrant. The end of the third scene is nearly unbearable in its concentration on Macduff's grief over the news that Ross brings. After having dissembled about the matter, he informs the man that his wife and children, note the plural, the other kids aren't present in Act 4, Scene 2, have been cruelly slain by Macbeth's agents. Macduff is stunned, and Malcolm's inexperience shows when he immediately tries to harness Macduff's grief. This future king sounds like a young man filled with valorous words from some classical manual of rhetoric. In response, Macduff says, quote-unquote, he has no children. Act 4, Scene 2, line 216. Who is Macduff's pronoun referring to here? He could, of course, be talking about Macbeth as a now childless man, and that is how many readers interpret the sharp response. But it may be that the pronoun is part of an aside that refers instead to Malcolm, who, as a very young man, can't feel the loss of children as a father would. If this reading is correct, Macduff is somewhat rebuking Malcolm's insensitive exhortation to take his revenge against Macbeth. Whomever the pronoun connects to, Macduff, unlike Macbeth, is still fully human and does not subscribe to the hardness doctrine of masculinity set forth by the usurping royal couple. Nature's bonds of affection are still powerful within him, and Macduff, ever the warrior, soon comes round to Malcolm's program of action. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Wednesday, July 23rd, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations from Macbeth, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition, 4-volume, genre-based format.